everybody, and welcome to another episode of What You Doin' Podcast, the interview show where I talk to amazing people about the cool things that they're working on. My name is Matt. Today I'm talking to Eric Lajour, a TTRPG editor who's worked on a number of projects, including Whisper in the Walls and Substratum Protocol for Pandion Games, Songs and Saga for Fari RPG, Paint the Town Red, but most recently, for Pandion, Midnight Muscadines. Now, hopefully you've been following along with Midnight Muscadines ever since my interview with Andy oh so long ago. I'm excited to say that just wrapped up on BackerKit to an amazingly successful funding run. I was very excited to talk to Eric to get insight on a part of the TTRPG creation process that I don't have a lot of insight into. Before we'll hop into it, I'll mention first that we had some audio issues with Eric's audio during the interview. It's just part of the process of recording over the internet. I'm trying to work on sort of a more reliable solution to prevent things like this from happening, but I don't think it's terrible. I just wanted to note that it is, you know, a little worse than usual. With that said, let's get to the interview.
Yeah, I remember because you were neighbors with Andy almost.
Yeah. We were very, very close. It was a funny thing to discover not long after I moved here.
Now Elin or a better world up north.
Yeah, I'm a little jealous. It's not that I hate it here. I just wouldn't mind moving. It would be nice to move somewhere that was like nicely walkable and, you know, had.
I think Andy wanted to also change the political climate a little.
Mm-hmm. It's bluer here. Which I realize as a Canadian, you might not understand the reference. Like it's more democratic. It's more progressive here than overall, but that's only a little bit more. You know what I mean? it's still fairly conservative just as the state. So
we have inverted colors in Canada. The conservative party is blue and the liberal is red.
I just learned that the other day. I was talking to a Canadian friend of mine and I was like, we were talking about something. I was like, do your political parties have like animals like ours do? And they're like, no, like we just have colors and the colors are the exact opposite of yours. And I was like, of course they are. Why wouldn't they be?
And for a while in Quebec, like my parents' generation, they would say sky is blue and hell is red. So it was really a taboo to vote red. But even in our history, the parties, they switched. Like, I think in the U.S. also, there was a time when Republicans were more liberal, like really, well, they still are, like very economic liberalism, like the state shouldn't be present and so on. But so in Quebec, blue has been paradise, and then now it's the opposite. But we have two blues because we have a Quebec party, like Bloc Québécois, a party just to represent Quebec at the federal level. So they have another blue for the Fleur de Lys.
Gotta love politics. It's so easy and simple and never confusing.
So how do we start, or is it already started?
it's technically already started. I usually I use some of the stuff at the beginning, depending on what we talk about. You know, sometimes during the interview, it's just chatting about like expectations, what we're going to be talking about during the thing. And so I trim that up. But if we have a funny convo, like I'll probably leave the little bit about like the political parties and stuff just as like a lead in. Just because I think it's fun to leave in a little banter at the beginning, you know? Oh, now I hear that chainsaw. I heard that. It sounds like you have like a cow outside.
I'm in the middle of Montreal and I'm like on the island in a very dense residential neighborhood. So it's the one in a million that
what does he even have to chainsaw? What is there to be chainsawing?
I don't know.
The one tree. He's like, this today's the day. It's coming down.
I moved here 2 years ago and I still don't know much about that neighbor. So his life is a mystery, and perhaps it's better if it remains that way.
You know, that's fair. If you're like, you know, maybe today's not the day to try to learn a bunch about it. Maybe we let him chainsaw in peace. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Whatcha Doin' Podcast. My name is Matt. Today, I'm sitting down with Eric. Eric, say hello.
Hi. I'm Eric Lasbur, but just Eric is fine.
I've never had someone insist on their entire name the whole time, and that would be very interesting. I love hearing this chainsaw. I'm not going to call it out a bunch during the interview, but it's very funny. It's right at the back of the sound channel. It's so funny.
The neighbor has only a few logs remaining. Hopefully in 2 to 5 minutes, it should be done.
It's so funny to think that like 5-6 years ago, we would have had to cancel. We would have just been like, no, like the sound is impossible. And then now like technology has gotten a weird spot where it's just like, yeah, it's just like a small annoying sound that, you know, will go away eventually. And that's fine. Eric, go ahead. Give us a timeline of your work in TTRPGs. Just sort of a rough, you know, who you are, what you've been doing, little intro, and then we'll dive into the questions and everything.
Sure. I'm a kid from the 80s, born and raised near Montreal in a francophone area. I actually learned English playing D&D because the older kids on my street wanted a player, even if I was the little brat. They said, yeah, come in, we'll show you the ropes. And one of my earliest pictures, Christmas, I was 5-6, and I have the old Forgotten Realms box. I've been playing D&D and then other role-playing games since the 80s. I played through high school, discovered other systems. Then life got in the way. Studied history, traveled a lot, studied law, worked, practiced law, and then decided that I didn't want to have my soul crushed for too long. So I stopped practicing, but I went into editing. So I'm now editing legal books in Montreal. I think we'll come back to that topic, but it's a great asset to edit TTRPGs to come from a place where we have two languages and two legal systems. It really, I think I don't have the same perspective as many editors in the States, where it's more like there's one way to do it. Like you have the Chicago style guide, or in our environment where we have different legal system, two languages, we're used to having books where everything is different. Every author has his own way, his or her own way. Anyways, I digress. The pandemic hit, and it was the perfect occasion to get back into TTRPGs. A group randomly on Facebook, and we started playing Urban Shadows, fell in love with narrative games in general. Quickly tried to devour other games, found out about the indie TTRPG scene, and quickly wanted to edit games. I thought my skills could be useful. I saw RP. I think everyone knows almost. the Egelina, a guy from Quebec, from my province, and he was promoting Stoneburner at the time. And I sent him a message on Twitter, the place we shall not speak of anymore. And his first reaction was, I had a bad experience with an editor. I said, give me a shot. I'll edit a sample for you for free just to see if we like to if we can vibe, if we you want you like how I work, and the rest is history. I work with RP on Stoneburner, also worked on Lord Sworn, another Kickstarter in 2 years ago. And through RP, I met Andy Boyd of Pandion Games. I edited Substratum Protocol. And this year, I actually took a leave from my job, a 10-week leave to focus on TTRPGs. I was able to edit smaller and bigger games. Edited Let's Go to Romino, a small game for kids. Paint the Town Red, I contributed on that game. And now I've been working for months now on Midnight Muscadines, Companion Games, Dungeon Bound, Harry RPG's next project, as well as Calpini and One Way Out. So it's been a great 10 weeks, and it's ending this week. So I'm going to go back to the day job. But the dream is still alive that maybe I can eventually really just work on TTRPGs, perhaps board games as well, or other types of, but editing law books for a big multinational company that is now intent on driving AI everywhere is not what I what I want to do for a long time.
We got to it quicker than most other episodes. We hit the point in the episode where we all get to say fuck AI. It's great. It's come up almost every episode, but you know, we got, like I said, we got there quicker than most. But yeah, taking 10 weeks off of a job and then going back to it is wild. I've never had that much of a break from a job, even just taking a week. And then coming back, I feel like on Monday, like, what did I do? Well, how do I do this? What did I do? What do I do here?
I'm dreading next Monday. Let's not talk about it.
You're right. That's not what we're here to talk about.
Yeah, the leave was a great opportunity. I was able to also try designing games or content for games during that time. So I wish it upon everyone. Despite the AI, that's the good side of the company. Like once every 5 years, you can take a leave like that.
Oh wow, that's pretty nice. That it's just like, yeah, okay, you can take some time. I like that.
Normally, my trademark maneuver is just to resign after a certain number of years. And travel the world and come back, but now I have a house and a kid and a girlfriend, so obligations, huh?
I like the idea. You're like, yeah, it's just about time to oh no.
Damn.
I'll take 10 weeks off instead. I will take the 10 weeks, just please, thank you. I guess the first thing I want to ask is more about like doing the work than the actual work. I'm just going to write it down. We got to get RP on the podcast at some point, because this is the second or third time he's come up, and I think that seals it.
He's done so much for the community. It's incredible. The systems that he's given like Breathless and others, and now he's working on an alternative to Itch and Dice Rollers, SRDs. He's a very generous person, and if we could all like fund his full time work on TTRPG, I know you would like to take a leave also, but
Yeah, sadly, the thing holding most people back is they still got to have a day job. But you know, we were
and in our climate, the economic and political and the economy, I think it's worse than ever. We can talk about Midnight Muscadine's currently crowdfunding, but I think these current days and weeks are pretty rough, and I think it will be difficult in the short term for smaller projects, but we have to push on.
Yeah. The worst answer is to give into despair. So it has been more difficult to do the show and to do my day job. You know, I'm a streamer, and to try to put on a positive. I don't want to say put on a happy face, because that feels like it's an act. Like, try to have a positive attitude, try to bring a positive attitude to people with everything going on. But it's so important even now. You know, it's more important now to try to just keep working on the small distractions for people, the small bits of art that you know, help, you know, that get people happy, help people get through the day. You know, that's my view on it, at least, is, you know, putting that creative effort out there, putting the positive energy out there is the best thing you can be doing, and voting and political action and stuff like that. But obviously
we're seeing the influence and the reaction of the community, games about resistance, about fighting back and not accepting oppression, and also some games that are more heartwarming, just cozy and provide some feel good moments.
Right. Yeah, it can be a very tricky balance to have something let you focus those positive feelings and sort of recharge your positive energy. It came up during another episode, but I really accidentally picked the best time to start a podcast to give people a platform to promote their things, because all of the other platforms to promote their things are starting to fall to AI and have problems and all of this. So accidentally picked the best time to do this. But let's talk about editing, because I think in terms of the creative process, editing is the thing that I think going into TTRPGs, just in my personal history of playing TTRPGs and being aware of them and then digging more into them, I think editing and the next layout is probably the two parts that I gave the least thought to. This came up in a different episode, but you know, when I was talking to Ryan about illustrations and stuff like this, I was like, I can very distinctly remember when I was getting into TTRPGs, I was not reading the work as a work, right? I was reading the words and I was like, oh, well, this is the game. We got the words right here. And the illustration stuff went there. The illustration was there, the layout, all of that work had been done, but I didn't see the whole picture, you know? And I think editing is probably the one that disappears the most. Because I think if you have solid editing, you just read it and you're like, oh, good, cool, great, done.
Exactly. It's sometimes they say in boxing, a referee you don't see or you don't remember seeing during the match. Mm-hmm. So a good editor, you don't notice and their impact, their influence on the work. But I think if there is no editor or a bad one, then you don't necessarily know that the editing is an issue, but I think it's a ton of little things that you read or you play a game, and it doesn't just something is off. The mechanics are a little funky, and the setting doesn't really inspire you. What I like about editing TTRPGs is, at least for me, there's no book about it. I just started. I've read tons of TTRPGs before, but there was no one telling me you should edit that way. Mm. So I took my knowledge of legal editing, and I think principles of legal interpretation are really important, and they really help me out. But when I get on a project, on a TTRPG, I prefer, and some designers are less inclined, but I prefer when I have freedom to touch on everything. Mechanics, and not just, I think many persons think editors will find typos, will find a couple of inconsistencies in layout or punctuation. That can be the case, but I prefer to have the complete picture and try to help the designer. I want the designer to the work to really convey and to speak to the reader. And sometimes designers don't realize that for them something is crystal clear in their head there, but how you can read it, how it can be interpreted. So that's why I really prefer to start really early in the process. For Midnight Muscadines, Andy approached me when it was still a draft for a game jam, like in September. And we've been working 7-8 months now on the game, really closely. And I don't want to humble brag, but I think I've really helped not only with the writing, but the mechanics, how the structure of the game. It's basically, I want to be like, just to provide an outside perspective. When you write something, whether a game or a novel, your brain starts to it's automatic. You finish the end of your sentences in your brain. You do that even for mechanics in a game. So you don't read them anymore. You see them, but you don't read them. And designers make changes here and there, punctual changes all the time, and they don't realize the impact on the rest of the game, on other mechanics, and they start to, your brain plays tricks on you. I think you really need someone with an outside perspective, and I'm glad to be there. Sometimes it's hard. Some designers just want you to look at the language, find some typos. I'm someone who likes to be brutally honest with my friends in my personal life in general. And it always surprises me when someone doesn't appreciate brutal honesty. I try to be more diplomatic as I get older, but some designers, you have to, in French we say, wear gloves when you like when you suggest or criticize. But I feel like I'm not doing my job if I don't tell you. And of course, you don't have to agree. We won't agree on everything. In the games I've edited, some things in the final product I would have done differently, that's fine. Ultimately, I'm not the designer. They have their creative freedom. But let me propose, let me suggest, let me raise issues, and then you can deal with it. I don't even remember where this question started. I think, of course, I like to work on the language, in the setting, in the mechanics, but I also like to work on the mechanics themselves, on the structure, on the layout. In my day job, I really handle everything. Working with the illustrator, working with the person doing linguistic revision. I'm more of a like supervisor that must manage every aspect. So I like to do the same thing with TTRPGs. And that's it. I think designers should give it a try. We're all in the indie scene. We're all like, we want to help each other out. We don't want to sell each other short and work for nothing, but tons of editors out there will like edit a sample for you. They want to show you, and designers should try it. Sometimes I reach out to designers on their crowdfunding games or promoting games. And I've gotten some contracts by editing or raising issues, like in the one or two pages they post online on social media. And so I think our task and the value we add is not obvious, as you said at first, but it can make a huge difference. And at the end, when players are playing your game, I think if it's really like you bring it to another level, and you won't notice the editing, but everything in the game, in the reading experience, and then in playing the game will feel smoother. At least that's my hope for the games. And I haven't had that much experience with TTRPGs, but I think I'm improving as I go along every game I'm doing. And this one, Midnight Muscadine, is a big one. Like editing a 180-page book is...
That's not nothing.
No, it's huge. I'm used to it. We have some books, 3,000 pages, legal books, mm-hmm. at my day job. So I'm used to... bigger project and trying to really see the whole puzzle, but I love it. It's gaming has been a passion, whether TTRPG or board games, card games, and using my skills in such a field is really rewarding, especially when you find designers that want to interact. And I've been really lucky. RP and D are wonderful people.
Yeah, that's
the... I don't know if that answered your question.
But... No. I mean, that's always the hope, right? Is that you can use what you're good at to live your passion and do what you're passionate about. I think, you know, a lot of people are like, well, this is the thing that I'm good at, so this is the thing that I'll do. And that's, you know, that's their job. And you know, they make money and that's fine. That, you know, listen, I'm not going to poo-poo anybody for having a job. But I think it's more enjoyable when you can use your skills and you feel good about the outcome at the end of the day, right? For something like this, where you're like, you know, you work on the book and it goes through crowdfunding and you get out and people are excited about it. You're like, I did that. Like I was a part of this. I helped bring this together. It's probably a better feeling than like some law book. You're just like, yep, that one. That was me.
And what's great about it also is that because you're working with people sharing your passion, you often have things in common, and most of the time you become friends, and it becomes like you root for each other. I think there's a strong sense of community in the TTRPG scene. Mm-hmm. And it's almost a danger, I think, for an editor. Sometimes I'm too involved. I have to take a step back. Like for Midnight Muscadines, I'm looking at the crowdfund and the numbers. And like, Andy is in control. Let the designer do his thing. But when you work so much in a project, it's difficult to have some distance. But I think I should have tried to keep a little distance, because you don't want to become also overbearing and suggest too many things when the product is great, and you can always then do better. But at one point you have to say, no, that's it. It's done, and we have to throw it mm-hmm. out there and see how the world reacts.
Right. We have to call it good.
Until we make a second edition.
You've already got notes for second edition. You're like, you know what, actually, like, maybe, you know, the rules for this were actually really sloppy. We could just improve them. Send it to Andy as soon as the crowdfunding is done. Like, Andy, if you're thinking about a second edition, here's my notes.
I'm kidding, but in our community, I'm saying that word too much, but many people release games on itch or free. They give community copies, they release alpha version or sometimes full version, but it's their first games they've ever designed. And like Andy, for example, has been releasing second editions of some of his games. It's fine, and it's normal. But that leads to another subject. I think I'm not sure if it's a problem. I think it is that there are so many, anyone can design a TTRPG. Basically now the tools are available. It's not that expensive to get Affinity, and there are so many designers out there, and designers, it's more, I think, economically viable and perhaps stimulating to always design new games mm-hmm. instead of content for existing games. Bigger companies also do that, like Free League. Mm-hmm. A company that I used to love, but now it's just one Kickstarter after the other, one game after the other, and the games are not supported that much. And then I hope that we can have the resources and the time to also support some of our games, because we're kind of telling the customers also, like, buy my new game, we're telling them to move on from your previous game every time you release a new game. And then we wonder why some of the games don't have success, like a D&D. And of course, you're not going to match a mega corporation like you would. But I'm digressing a lot. But I think, yeah, I hope to do a, I might not be good to design new games, but I'm working on writing games or content for existing games. So I can't stop to bother RP or Andy about Stoneburner or Muscadines and just make some small expansion and try to put a, my toes in the water to eventually design a game.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and it's, there's not really a perfect answer, right? Of like, if you want to design something, like, you know, how long should you support a game? What does that support look like? You know, I've definitely seen a lot of different designers, you know, editors and creators talk about it. And it's a tricky subject, right? Because like you said, like, they're definitely, there's definitely an issue with Kickstarter having sort of taken the place of what used to be like commercial risk, you know, where businesses would just say like, okay, like, do we feel that this project will make its money back once it comes to market, and, you know, weighing that and sort of changing maybe their products or something like that. Whereas with Kickstarter and other crowdfunding, they can just get it all up front and, you know, they don't have to do market testing or anything. They can just be like, how do people like this? And more often than not, if you're a company like Free League or, you know, like Goodman with DCC, those projects will fund just because you have a really large sort of embedded fan base already. You have people who want to buy whatever the next Free League thing is, whatever the next DCC thing is, whatever the next Monty Cook thing is, just kind of on the face of it. And so, like you said, it means that in a lot of times it feels more like they're pushing you to get the next thing and not supporting the last thing that they sold you as well as they should. And then it, you know, it trickles down. I think it's a difficult question, you know, and I think it's, you know, not an easy answer, because, you know, it's like, okay, we'll make an adventure. It's like, okay, well, nobody buys the adventures that I made for $7.
It's a vicious circle. Like, some designers are saying, I'm not earning that much money, so I'm going to do what I feel like doing. Mm-hmm. So I'm inspired to create something new, and it's not rewarding enough economically to really invest. So, and they're doing that for the fun, but I think it's a danger that you're also always just staying in that loop of doing it for fun. Mm-hmm. And well, I'm really curious to see, like, for example, Andy from Panion Games, he's the star of the show so far. he quit his job this year to pursue that full time, Panion Games, and so it's very courageous, very bold, and I look forward to seeing how he's gonna develop single or one man company. But he's also great of getting collaborators, and I think for most with the day job, it's so difficult to, it's rewarding to work in your passion and to create, but it's also demanding. It's mm-hmm. It's exhausting to be creating, and many designers that I've been following, working with, there's a fatigue after working on a game, and you can't just chain them and work all the time.
Yeah, I've seen some designers do that, where they, you know, they're talking a lot about a game, and, you know, it goes to crowdfunding and stuff, and then it funds, and they're like, all right, I don't want to talk about this for 3 months. we're gonna finish it, and we're gonna print, we're gonna do whatever we gotta do. Don't talk to me about it. It's done. I don't want to talk about it.
And there are so many unpleasant aspects that are tacked on, like tax issues, the European regulations and oh.
Yeah, what it's a thing that is surprising to me to learn, but is also not that surprising. Like the first time I learned about VAT, like as an American, the first time I learned about VAT, I was like, what? And like customs is a thing like I'd heard, but once you learn how you're like, wait a minute. I remember someone was talking about customs. Like, wait a minute. You're telling me you buy a thing from someone, right? Right. And you pay them for it, right? And they ship it to you, right? And then you have to pay the government to let you have it? Yeah. And I'm not going to say America is great, but that's wild. Like, that's what?
Well, you guys are lucky. Some states don't have sales tax or almost none. And the reality is that 99% of projects come from the States. So you back a project, it gets shipped to you at relatively low shipping cost. Mm-hmm. But outside of the US, with shipping and with customs and taxes, the last 2-3 years, the number of projects I've backed that dropped 90%. I'm sometimes backing games and having them shipped to my sister living in New York, so that she can bring them to me. It's not viable anymore to buy games, and I should embrace like just buying the PDF, but I want the book. I want the physicality of a book, and I think most TTRPG players appreciate having the physical object. It's crazy to think how much work goes in the book in a TTRPG. I'm working on legal books that are being sold $300 that have print runs in the thousands, and the amount of time, energy invested in layout, in art, is a fraction of what small indie creators are investing in their books.
And then they'll be like, and it's $50. Here you go. Here's this beautiful book full of art and effort. It's $50. Thank you.
I brought some of my TRPG at work one day, because most of the people there are not gamers. It's an older crowd, and they were completely amazed at the quality of the books. And it's partly like a shame on my multinational company for making crappy books, but at the same time, kudos to designers. They're really making works of art. That's why I like to have the physical books, but it's becoming more and more difficult to get that.
Yeah, especially now. Hey, like you said, in the States, it's so cheap. Not anymore. We fixed it. It's expensive for us too. Yay!
For books, I think you're still fine, but
maybe
games with for now.
Maybe
board games are really suffering immediately. But I think, unfortunately, like the current policies are doing something that has some good in it, For example, Pandion Games is producing and printing and trying to really get the work done in the States, not in China. I think most people would, in an ideal world, like to produce games in Canada, in the States, and not have to rely on cheap labor from the other side of the world. But it's a lose-lose situation for now.
Yeah, it's certainly that. I want to talk to. Referenced it a little bit at the beginning. I kind of wasn't surprised to find out that you had worked as a legal editor, because I feel like that's the perfect job to have if you want to edit TTRPGs. I feel like that's the exact perfect job. If it's like, okay, now what do you do for your day job, Eric? I edit books full of sort of esoteric information and terms that have very specific meanings that get used multiple times with a lot of examples. And what do you do for fun? I edit these books with a lot of esoteric words with specific meanings that get used a lot.
It's very similar. And as I mentioned earlier, principles of legal interpretation can be applied almost all the time, but in many fields, but for TTRPGs, where you have basically laws, you have like your core laws in your system, and then you have exceptions, and when there's a conflict, a difficulty, how do you interpret something? Because legal interpretation and laws in general, whatever we may think of specific regulations currently, it's mostly based on common sense. Whether it's common law or more civil law that we have in Quebec, we have both systems. Like our civil law comes from France, but our criminal law and common law comes from Britain and the US and North American influence. So we have both systems here. But at the end of the day, it's common sense, and the interpretation principles are trying to give you hints to resolve issues, but also through common sense. Like, one of the main principles in legal interpretation is the legislator does not speak for nothing. If there's something written, it has to have an effect. So if there's an interpretation of a rule that would have no impact, then that interpretation must feed to an interpretation which makes that sentence have an effect, some practical effect. It's really simple. People would say, well, it's obvious. But when you have these principles, you can apply them to TTRPG mechanics. I try to cut anything that can be cut. Like, being verbose and being... Sometimes it's great to put examples, but sometimes designers don't realize that by trying to reformulate a rule, like saying it two ways, that's where the issue comes from. If your first sentence, if your first rule is clear, remove the rest. Okay? Don't open the door yourself for conflicts. It's my first approach. If something can be removed, remove it. Everything that is there has to be there. for mechanics mostly, like lore is another issue. You want some flavor, you want some flourish sometimes. But mechanics, the shorter they can be, the less confusing they will be. And I'm not someone who loves crunchy games. I want mechanics. The mechanics are important, but I want mechanics that serve the story and that also, like, you forget them. Mm-hmm. You learn them, but then you forget them because they are integrated well in the team, so they become natural. I've refused some projects where they're just too crunchy. I understand. I used to love that as in another era, but when TTRPGs become more like board games, I prefer to play a real board game. If I want to play a TTRPG, I want the focus to be on the story. I want games where there's no GM or the players can feed, contribute to the story. Min-maxing is something that I don't derive pleasure from, but it's fine. There are games for people who like that, but I accept projects where it's not the focus, so the few mechanics there are, we want them to be super sharp and to be really clean, efficient. And I've been lucky to work with designers that also think that way, that like they always they want to, even if there are 10, 15, 20 pages of in the rules chapter, they must all fit on a 1 or 2 page summary. And I appreciate that. If you can't summarize your mechanics, like if you can't give a good summary of your setting, then something's wrong. Then you should understand what type of story you want to tell, what type of game you want to play. And I think some designers forget that. They get too much in either the world, or they're fascinated by a mechanic they've designed, and they forget about just how will it play. And what story do you want to tell? What do you want to be the experience around the table? I recently like barged in on a successful Kickstarter. I won't name the game. No, maybe I should. I don't know. But they had a quick start available, and I read it, and the game had a massive success in Kickstarter. But it was not edited, and some mechanics just didn't work. They just didn't work. They didn't. The designers didn't realize the impacts of certain elements. Like for some classes, they were saying character creation, you can choose one of each category of skills. And they didn't realize that the way they build their skill tree, like 90% of the classes and options, there were no options at all because there was only one choice that respected the mechanic. Mm-hmm. You didn't even have a choice. And they didn't realize like the advancement system, how you build it. But do you try to figure out like how many dice rolls do you need to get one advance? If you want your players to get some satisfaction, to get one advance every session or two, well, if your system requires like 40 dice rolls, is that the experience you want around the table? Like, you're forcing, incentivizing the players to be always rolling the dice? Are you getting away from the story if you're doing that? that's part of the big picture that some designers are losing when they're hyper focused on, you know, the world or certain mechanics they think is really cool. I think there's a lot of gimmicks sometimes, and I want something that is pure. Just the mechanics shouldn't be the star. The story and the interaction between the players is what, for me, ultimately makes a good time. And anyway, as I said, you can play Gloomhaven or D&D if you want the mechanical puzzle, but prefer other types of game.
Yeah, and you hit on a thing that I always try to keep in mind when I'm reading a game is thinking about, you know, I'm sort of moving away from more crunchy, you know, like mechanics driven games. Like I played Pathfinder for like a decade, and so I'm starting to like not move away from, but you know, I'm branching out into all these different games. But it's a thing I always have in the back of my head of like, if a game has advancement, what does that advancement look like? And I think you phrased it really well of like, how many dice rolls does it need? You know, what sort of quantifiable metric is there that like, okay, it's a thing that like works really well in like Blades in the Dark or Apocalypse World or those sorts of games, because you're rolling the dice anytime you want to do a thing, and then your advancement is tied to failing those rolls. And that incentivizes you, and in some cases de-incentivizes you from rolling the dice a lot. You know, you want to be doing things, and it rewards you for failing. And it sort of says like, you know, don't roll all the time, because some, you know, some things are just going to work. But when, you know, when there's other, when it's like, oh, you know, you get an XP or get an advance when such and such and such, it's like, okay, how often should that be happening? How often should we and it's why I enjoy in systems that don't have XP having clear, like one of my favorite examples with this is 13th Age by Rob Hinesu. Is you get, it's, you know, it's very D&D like. I don't think he would have any problem with that description. It's very heroic fantasy, very, you know, numbers, very crunchy, very dice rolly. But your advancement is super clear. You get one bit of your level up every session. So if it's like, oh, you're going to get three things when you level up, you can be like, okay, at the end of the session, like I'm going to take my hit points. I'm going to get more hit points. And then once you get all those advancements, then you're that next level. And that's such a fun, clear way to convey, here's how you advance. It also, I think in a fun, sneaky way, incentivizes you to play shorter sessions. Because it's like, oh, don't come over Saturday and play for 6 hours. Come over Saturday, we'll play for like 2 hours. We'll go to lunch, and then we'll play another 2 hours, and then you get two advancements. But yeah, I think you hit on a thing that has bugged me in more than a couple games of having that. And I think, like you've said, it, like you've mentioned a couple times, the sort of clarity that good editing can bring you. Sometimes when I'm reading a book, you know, a TTRPG book specifically, or even like another great example is like Rules for a Board Game, since that's the closest analog. You get this sort of floaty feeling where you're not really sure how some of these things are supposed to go together, where you're like, okay, I've got this thing that I've got this part, and I've got this part, and then I've got this part. And it's like, how are they supposed to like overlap? Are they supposed to sit next to each other? How? And I think this, I think that's a big thing when it comes to how people respond to a game, reading a game specifically, is that sort of clarity of like, oh, I understand exactly what I'm supposed to do. I understand where we make the characters, we do this, we have like phases or whatever, we're rolling dice in these parts, we move on through this, boom, done, I got it. And I think people don't realize how often that's because of work like editors and you know, people doing layout. Just that sort of clarity of language.
To play devil's advocate, something I always do, I agree with you, but at the same time, the danger is a lot of games now, they want to have this, what's the play loop? And what's the game loop? And it brings that clarity, like you start and you know like the acts in the play, you know how it's going to unfold, and it has value and it can help you pace and it can be rewarding. But at the same time, there's a danger that it becomes a recipe, that it becomes always the same, repetitive. I mentioned my Urban Shadows campaign during the pandemic, I think at the start. I had never played a PBTA, and I played it with a group that at least they played it how I now want to play my Art of the Apocalypse game. And sometimes people tell me, I don't like PBTA. And when I ask them how they play, it's not like I do. I think it's one of those polarizing systems.
That's definitely true.
Give me Art by the Apocalypse every day over Blades in the Dark or Forge in the Dark for personally, because it was like a collection of scenes. There was no game loop like we prepare the heist, we do the thing, and then there's the downtime. It was like completely free-form narrative. Everyone created scenes and contributed and helped them make sense and evolve. And ultimately, it was rewarding and it brought character development that I had never seen in a TTRPG. So I'm trying to balance that. You have to have some structure, but I also like the old, just total freedom. And we start, we know where we start, but we don't know where we're going to end. And it's more daunting. If I can, let's compare, for example, I worked on Substratum Protocol, and it's almost, even if you play it over a couple of sessions, it's like a one shot, because there's this purpose and there's this end point where you reach the anomaly at the center of the earth. So that is quite structured, and you know what you're going to do, and you know the tone, you know the mechanics, you know you're going to end with the hypothesis about the anomaly. And now in Midnight Muscadines, it's scarier when you work on a project that is, it's more like there's a world out there. We're giving you mechanics to interact with the world. Hopefully they mesh well with the team. But go out there. Have fun, discover the world. And we have some advancement, but because we wanted to have this freedom, we decided to have two advancement systems. One, to have like punctual small bonus that arrive from time to time, depending on your role, and then more long-term point that you can spend on bigger advancements when you accomplish a mission or quest, or and we leave a lot of freedom for the players what they determine is like this milestone. Andy and I wanted a game where it's more like go out there and we trust you, you're gonna have fun in this world and you can but make your own adventure. Yeah, I love storytelling games. Sometimes people don't see them as TTRPGs. I think they are like games like Fall of Magic or For the Queen. Mm-hmm. I consider them a subset of TTRPGs. And I think I don't want all games to be like that. Almost no mechanics, and people say it's just basically improv, and I want the game, not just doing theater or improv. But people should try them out more. It really teaches you and helps you embrace like the freedom, the narrative freedom, and take risks and make a story together. And I think we can bring that richness in a game with some more mechanics. At least that's what we're trying to do.
And I think Fall of Magic and For the Queen, like as specific examples, are a really interesting thing that I think might appeal to some people if they haven't enjoyed other TTRPGs, because you trade mechanical freedom for narrative, or I guess you trade narrative freedom for mechanical freedom, right? You don't have like set specific mechanics in something like For the Queen. Like your character can be whatever you describe them, you know, there's no limitations, there's no points, there's no whatever. But what you in getting that mechanical freedom, what you give up is narrative freedom, because when you play For the Queen or Fall of Magic, you have the same base sort of story prompt. You know, in Fall of Magic, you're escorting the magician, magic is dying, you're going on this quest, right? And you get the same, you know, effectively the same prompts, and you're directed with these examples, you know, you're like, this is happening. What is your feeling? How does the queen feel about this? What did you do to make the queen mad? You know, example. Imagine I have more examples. And what I think that's very interesting, and I do think more people should play For the Queen specifically. I think For the Queen is amazing. I also adore Fall of Magic. I think it's way easier to recommend For the Queen, though. I think it's way easier to be like, you should buy this $20 box of cards than like $130 big canvas scroll. As much as I adore it, I love it. I have it. It's beautiful. It's much easier to recommend For the Queen, though. But what I think it allows you to do is it allows you to stretch different muscles as someone that does role playing games. You know, you're not as much worried about, you know, playing a PBTA or something like that. You're not as much worried about, you know, mechanical positioning, fictional positioning, whatever. You're more worried about like, how do I come up with an interesting scene? I have this prompt. How do I come up with an interesting narrative for what's happening? We know at the end that the queen is going to be attacked. How do I feel about that? Do I want to set out and be like, I will betray the queen? And then how do I see that through this story?
I wouldn't play Fall of Magic 10 times in a row. No. Or the queen. There are like special moments when you play them, and of course the prompts and For the Queen will come back or something, but as you say, it stretches muscles. And a lot of players that we've all been there, when we start playing TTRPGs at a young age, you're kind of insecure, you don't know what it is, and the mechanics sometimes are there, they give you comfort and security. You can rely on them. You want to do that? Okay, I roll the dice. It's simple, and it also helps to drive the story forward. Even the GM doesn't sometimes hasn't figured out a whole narrative. But when you start to do it, when you play a more traditional TTRPG, but with that, with those muscles stretch and with everyone around the table, like we're five heads are better than one. Mm-hmm. Like we're starting a scene, the GM has an idea, but another player says, hey, we could do that instead. I have a great idea. Why not? Let's do it. I don't care about the pre-written adventure. I don't care about the bad guy that I wanted to introduce later. This is a great idea. Let's run with it. And we'll figure things out. And sometimes things won't be perfect, but that's fine. And we can rewind. But I think people, you have to trust. And if everyone is in it together, it can be amazing. And more games are doing that. I think they want players to contribute to. They want GMs to say, no, you tell me what's in the room. I don't have to. You tell me. And I think it's so simple that it took decades before we saw the light about doing that. For example, I'm not a big follower, not a follower at all of the Critical Role, but I was curious about Daggerheart, their new system that they're designing soon to come out, and they're embracing that as well. And I think it's a sign that people are ready to go there. Even people who have mostly played D&D, Pathfinder, there's nothing that stops you from not rejecting, but sometimes leave your old paradigms and embrace, like, no, we're not gonna buy this adventure or this campaign. We'll make a story, we'll each contribute, and in those types of game, the simpler the mechanics, the easier it is to concentrate on the story.
Yeah, and most of the time, the pre-written adventure that you're reading anyway is probably the same thing you would come up with around the table. It's not to poo-poo anybody's quality, not to name names, not to point any fingers at anyone specific, but a lot of the times, pre-written stuff is great as a framework to use to say, okay, you know, here are some locations, here's some narrative threads, that sort of thing. It's nothing that you couldn't come up with yourself. You know, you just, you know, like you said, pass the scenes around the table, take input, you know, work on it together, collaborate. You're most of the way there anyway.
Games can provide starting point, like hooks, small mysteries and small encounters. I prefer that. And then you start and see where it goes. Because let's go back to the fuck AI argument. Sometimes you see people on social media saying, like, I use ChatGPT to help me with adventures, and my first reflex is like, why are you even playing a role-playing game if you don't want to use your creative muscles and come up with an adventure? But to play the devil's advocate, then it's the same thing with buying a pre-written adventure, even if it's written by a human. some are great, but ultimately, like, if the TTRPG experience you want around the table is crafting a story, or is it rolling dice and like reacting to a story, more like a puzzle, like a and it can be fun, like to see if your character can handle this specific dungeon or puzzle or challenge. For me, the fun of creating the story outweighs it by 100. But you still want mechanics. You still want to have these moments at the table where everything rolls on a dice, hangs on a dice, or it's fun. And it's part of like owning a book. It's fun to have dice or cards to flip. And I love the fact that we have now, we're moving away from just dice. We're having other ways, drawing, using cards or Jenga blocks. Or I think it helps people realize that that's not the... It helps to just tear down the old systems and think, approach things with a new approach.
Yeah, you don't have to. It's a thing I always love to bang the gong about is like we don't have to do something just because we've always done it that way. You know, we don't have to roll d20s just because we've always rolled d20s. We don't have to roll dice just because we've always rolled dice. We don't have to use minis on a map just because we've always used minis on a map. I think I saw Spencer Campbell of Gila RPGs. He designed a diceless system not that long ago, and I think I saw him say, if I'm misquoting, if Spencer hears this, that's great. If I'm misquoting, tell me. I think he was like, I'm glad I did a diceless game. I don't think I'm gonna do another one. and I think it's good that he set out to say like, I'm gonna make a diceless game. This is how it's gonna work. And he put his all into it, as far as I'm aware. And then, he went through it and he was just like, yeah, I think I'm okay. Because maybe you like diceless games. And, Thorn, I half played it with a friend of mine. We were setting up scenes and sort of discussing mechanics and stuff like that. So we were half playing, half discussing it. And it was interesting. It was an interesting new wrinkle to describe threats, describe scenes, describe actions, kind of go through the systems. And my buddy who played with me was like, nah, I like rolling dice. I like the randomness. I like the mechanics. And I was like, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But like, it was an interesting experience. And I think the worst thing you can do if you tried something new is like, all right, well, we tried a thing. We tried it and we know whether or not we like it.
As you said earlier, when we talked about structure, or you can't go in completely blind if the proposition of the game is too foreign, too alien, it's difficult. I just entered a shop while traveling in Europe in like 2001, and I saw a book in a game store, Nobilis, the second edition, the big white book. Mm-hmm. It was sealed. I couldn't open the pages, but it was so beautiful. I bought it. And it's one of the most fascinating TTRPGs ever written. It's a work of art. But 20, 25 years later, I've never played a game because it's so foreign, so... Like, it's diceless, but you're also playing these beings that are basically omnipotent, and it's like, what am I going to do? And how is this going to be a game? How will we make a story when we can't really relate to these beings, to this reality? So, I love it, but... was never able to get it on the table, and I wouldn't know where to begin. So you can't go too far. Well, it's great that people experiment like that, but we also, it's like contemporary art or anything. Do you want to push the envelope to the max, or do you want something that people will love and will relate, many people will relate to it and find it approachable? So I think I want to be involved in games that people will play, people will remember, they want to play again and again and remember the stories that were built with those games. I wouldn't want to just go fully experimental and make a game that 10 people will have on their shelves. Like, just like I stopped after my master's degree in history, like going to PhD writing. Like, it's important and it's valuable, but writing a thesis that 5 people in the world will read and that it is so... ultimately, I want people to play good games, and it's already so difficult to find your audience and to... I'm trying to segue and rap with Midnight Muscadines. That is the...
Oh, listen,
now I'm back here, kid.
Sometimes you don't have everyone. To segue. Sometimes you don't have to segue. Sometimes you just hard stop and you're like, all right, left turn. Here we go. There's no way to do it. Just, all right, that was a great conversation. And we're going to hard left turn.
Has stop with his chainsaw, so we have our full attention and we can mention that Midnight Muscadines is one backer away from 500 and 2 weeks left.
That's impressive.
So I hope it will end with a bang. We can maybe reach more stretch goals. Andy has a lot of cool ideas in store. So go take a look. We have a quick start that you can download for free with the full rules chapter and excerpts from other chapters, so it really gives a good idea of the game and what you can expect.
Yeah, I'm so excited. I was able to check out Midnight Muscadines back in, you know, when it was the sort of game jam version, the rough version, we'll call it, and Andy was nice enough to make sure I had a copy because I missed it. And then with the Kickstarter, it came down, and or the crowdfunding, it came down, all of that. And I read through it before, you know, we were chatting all of this. And it's such a fun idea. We talked about it a bunch in his interview. So if you haven't listened to that episode, go listen to that episode. But it's go ahead.
I'll end with one Muscadines anecdote, because on the backer kit now, I think Andy mentions that basically, for those who don't know, the magic in the game is made with gems. You have a jar and you collect ingredients, and you can mix and match ingredients up to 4. And in the base game, we have 52 ingredients. So, and even players with the same ingredients will create different spells, because we allow you to basically concoct your spell by using elements of the different ingredients. So Andy mentions, like, you can, I think there's over 500,000 possibilities of combinations. And when the game first draft Andy sent me in September, the gems were one ingredient. I said, Andy, you're doing a game about gems? that have only one ingredient? Maybe we could have more. Yeah, that's a good idea. I think my editing salary was paid just by that sentence 7 months ago. Now it's a complete system, and we've had so much fun since then building it up, and we're really proud of it too. We Andy made some proof copies, so the game exists. It's not vaporware. It's gonna be finished and printed in a timely manner. For me, it's the most. I love all the projects I've worked on, but this one, for now, is on top. I think it's our best work, my best work, and I hope it finds its crowd and it lives on for sometime.
Yeah. We found our segue. We talked about a segue. We found our segue. We're here to talk about partially Midnight Muscadines. I wanted to find our way back to it. In relation specifically to your work on the edit. So you mentioned Andy brought you on in September. Was it essentially like, give me an idea of what the timeline for that was, because I'm curious how a project like this comes together. So I imagine he did the game jam version and it was kind of rough, and he was like, okay, I want to build this out. You know, was it, you know,
in September he sent the draft of the game jam version because he still wanted to be a polished product. So we immediately started discussing like adding ingredients and where we wanted to go, because it took the Songs and Saga rule set. It was a Song and Saga jam, and Andy started to make some changes, and I knew I edited Songs and Saga, so I knew the system well. So I also had ideas on where the system didn't quite work for the game Andy wanted to make. And I think we worked in September, October. He published the game jam version, and we both knew we immediately, like, this needs to be bigger. This needs to become a full game. And in November, we started working on this new game. We discussed mechanics for like 2 months, really intensely. And at the same time, Andy was adding the lore, the setting, and he was showing these chapters, the mechanics and the lore, they fuel each other. So I had some ideas on both, but the key was really figuring out the mechanics in November, December. And then after the holidays, Andy said, yeah, it's in a good place. Let's bring it to Backer Kit. And we continue to work, adding, well, Andy. I'm giving myself credit, but Andy and probably 50 times the number of hours I did on the game, obviously. And collaborators, he's a true professional, really well organized, like all the steps he wants to go through, and the writers he wants to work with, and it's very orderly. And like the edit for the editor as well, I like, I don't know how some editors do it, like taking just a document at the end and doing it one pass. Mm-hmm. I want to do multiple passes because I want to digest it. You read it once, you kind of start to absorb it. A month later, you read it again, you realize some things. The more time you can give me, the better the finished product will be. And other like RP as well, and they realize that it helps to start early and just let's think about it. Let's brainstorm and always be ready to ask something that we thought was great, but don't get attached to anything. And because things evolve, and something that was great at the start, because of other changes, it's better to just throw it away. Mm-hmm. So we just made version after version, and now we're in a place where we're really confident that it works and it's ready to be shared.
I love that. You answered a question I was going to ask, which is like, I was going to say, like, you know, do you do just one big pass? Do you go through section by section? Do you go like, do you take the whole work as one in one go and then cycle back around? And I think that's, like you said, doing multiple passes, at least the way that I'm thinking of it, makes the most sense, right? You're like, okay, here it is. Let's go through. Let's polish off all the problems we can see. And then, okay, come back later. What problems do we notice now? Has to be hard though to cut parts of the game. You know, that's probably the hardest part, right? It's like, oh, can we? that's got to be the hardest part.
It's the hardest for the designer. I don't have chopping block.
You're like, I whatever. I don't care.
But no, the reality is the designer can't write everything at once. So even if you wanted to have the whole picture when you start an editing pass, it's not written yet. Some later chapter. So you have to edit what you have, keep everything in mind, but then later on, go back. You can't just edit the new parts. You have to go back, make sure it still works with the new. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of hours. It's a ballpark figure, but I'll probably spend like 80 hours or 100 hours on Muscat Knives as an editor. Can't imagine how much Andy is spending, but
but yeah, as an outro, Eric, you gotta go. Where can people find you? Where can people find your work? If people are like, I want Eric to edit my TTRPG, where should they go? Where can they find you?
Evius is on Blue Sky. Eric Lazur, in one word, ERICLAZURE, Blue Sky Social, or on itch, ericlazur.itch.io. I made a page with showcasing the games I've edited and a couple of projects that I've worked on, designed, or am working on. But we'll keep that for another episode next year.
I love the planning. I'm like, all right, next year we'll be back. I love it. But yeah, as always, Eric, thank you so much for making time. I really appreciate it. All the links to Eric's stuff will be in the show notes if you want to just a nice easy click link. But that's gonna be it for the show. Say bye, everybody.
Bye bye.
Thank you. All right, that's my chat with Eric. I want to thank Eric again so much for coming on the show, taking time out of his day to chat with me about this. It was interesting, again, much like when I talked to Ryan, it's interesting to get insight from someone who is not sort of the designer on a project, but someone who works alongside them, works in tandem. It's great to get more info and insight into the overall process, especially from people doing the roles that, like I mentioned in the interview, you might not immediately think of. As I mentioned at the top, Midnight Muscadine's just finished their backer kit run. I don't know if they're going to do late pledges, anything like that. Make sure you go check them out on socials or on their website so you can get all the info for whatever's going on. And make sure to follow Eric on Blue Sky so you can find out whatever cool project he's doing next. I want to thank everybody for listening. The podcast continues to be absolutely amazing. Such amazing people continue to say yes to be on the show. I'm at a fun little busy period again where so many people are wanting to do it, so many projects. And this is such a cool problem to have. If you're enjoying the show, thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Please consider sharing it with a friend, rating it on whatever platform you listen it to on, share it on social media, that sort of thing. If you got a couple extra bucks in your pocket and you come to the Patreon, you can help me pay for the hosting fees. But like I said, regardless, thank you for listening. Thank you for enjoying it. I'm going to go relax and play some Pokemon, and I'll see you in the next one.